Hi, everyone. My name is Brandon Barry Edwards, and I'm a creative director at Frog in Shanghai. I've been there for 5 years and helped start that studio up. And Kaj, would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Kaj. I'm a senior design researcher at Frog. I'm based in Shanghai, even though I'm originally from India and I've lived everywhere.
So we're going to talk a little bit about China today. Obviously, it's a big topic. We're going to cover a few different industries and just kind of give some high-level observations, but also we're going to dive into a few examples of things that we see in the research that we do, some of the issues that we see that consumers are facing, some of the behaviors, some things that are unique. Before we do, though, interested, has anyone in the room, show of hands, lived in or worked in China? Yeah? Just want to get a topicality here. Okay.
Nice.
Yep, so that's good to know. So for this presentation, we kind of expected that a little bit, that someone would have some experience with China. So some of this stuff may not be new, but some stuff may be new. What we try to do at Frog when we're understanding consumer behavior is look for things that are unique and look for things that are meaningful for our clients. So we'll show a few examples of those and talk about some of the issues that we face. So before I do that, one of the most interesting things for me personally about China is the creative people there. And this guy is a former coworker of mine. His name is Alien, and he's a designer of ours at Frog. And he makes his own toys. And he's one of hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of people around China that can make their own things. It's the backyard of making things. So he goes down to Shenzhen on the weekends and tours factories and looks at molds and does all these things just because he likes to sketch toys. Yeah, so there's something interesting about the ability to be able to make your own thing. And I think it's not just toys these days. We're seeing all different kinds of people do that. So before we get into anything too detailed, just a couple of things that we've observed in terms of cultural dynamics in China. One thing that we've seen is really unique is delivery. So the acceptance, affordances around delivery, the expectation that anything that can be delivered anytime. It's not just brands like McDonald's responding to this, but for example, if you spend any amount of time, you know that any corner shop will deliver anything in the shop, whether it's toothpaste or a cup of water, 24 hours a day almost, and they'll do that within a 2-block radius. So the expectation of delivery and having that kind of service is really strong in China.
Mm-hmm. All right, here's something else that happens in China on an everyday basis. We all buy things online, like everything from our groceries to a fridge. But when it actually gets delivered, we pay in cash. So in China, there's this whole trust around paying for things in cash. Most of us even pay our rent in cash. So it's only when somebody comes in, gives you the object, you check that everything's okay, and then you hand over a wad of cash. So nobody's actually paying online so much.
Another thing that impacts the decisions that we make when we think about new products is government policy. More specifically, in this case, is the one-child policy. And what we've been seeing over the years is that, obviously, that's being relaxed a bit. If it's not explicit, it's very implicit in the way that the government treats the one-child policy and the way that consumers and everyday people think about their family unit. Yeah. So when you think about how you create a product or a service for that, knowing that the family unit is changing from this to something else is something to consider.
Mm-hmm. Something that's deeply embedded in Chinese culture is this idea of gaming. So if you walk around a Chinese city early mornings and the weekends, you'll probably see a lot of people playing mahjong. That's like older people are playing mahjong, younger kids will get together and play video games. So this whole idea of like gaming is just part of the culture. And it's not just about socializing, but now we're actually starting to see how it's being used for education, for example. So great opportunity there.
This particular game is San Guo Shi, which is kind of about the history of China. And if you know anything about the Civil War of China, it's a little bit about that. And I think what we see more often than not is that more so than if you look at the apps like Foursquare and game dynamics of mobile application development or even other kinds of products and services, this is embedded inherently in Chinese culture for hundreds and hundreds of years. And yet We don't see a lot of companies taking advantage of that fact. So another thing is education. In America, the benchmark, traditionally the benchmark has always been, we've always heard at least, that the benchmark for education that the benchmark for children is around healthcare. But in China, it's not just healthcare, it's education. It's making sure that your child has the best possible education is going to get ahead in the world.
Mm-hmm. Here's something else that's really interesting for us in China. It's this whole idea of three generations living in the same house. So often it's the grandparents, the parents, and the young child. Now, the young parents are working, so it's really the grandparents who are bringing up their young child. And this has huge implications when we're selling products. So if you think about pest control, for example, and you think about how the grandparents actually trust traditional remedies and the younger generation actually want to try more modern things, there's some great opportunities there too.
And then finally is just scale. So one thing that we always have to take into account is how many people there are. This is really obvious, but I'll give you an example. We're redesigning the Twitter of China right now. There's 300 million users, and an average semi-popular user will have millions of followers. Millions. And so within 500 milliseconds of posting something, there have been 15,000 reposts and 8,000 comments. So how does that change the way we design the UI? It's something that we have to consider. And it's not just for digital products, obviously. It's for flow. Sorry. Tencent Weibo, yep. Yeah, so it's not just things like digital products. It's also physical infrastructure, hospital networks, these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. All right, next up, we're going to talk about cars. So let's look at what was happening with cars in 1977. So China had all of 1 million cars in 1977. That's it. Let's look at what's happening in 2008. That's shot up. It's 51 million now. But let's see what happens 3 years from then. This is 2011, just last year. Sorry. We've actually got 100 million cars in China, and that's growing exponentially. And that has huge implications on traffic management, new cars, how people are actually making decisions. And think about the fact that for young Chinese consumers, they haven't grown up with cars. So the car that they buy themselves in their 20s or their 30s is really their first car. And that has a huge impact on how they're choosing cars and even taking care of them and selling these cars and buying new cars. Okay, safety records. So in China, there isn't much trust in the police. So you know, if you're going to have an accident, there's probably going to be a lot of chaos, and it's going to erupt into a huge fight. And the traffic can be quite crazy. And think about like tier 2 and tier 3 cities in China. There's actually this trend of sometimes poor people standing deliberately in front of your cars or pretending to be knocked down so that they can claim that you hit them and then extract money out of you. So in order to counteract this, people actually hook up video cameras in this car. So that's what this is. So they hook this up and they use this every single day. And what this does is that it basically records your driving every day and it backs it up. So if ever there is a dispute or something bad should happen, you have your own record. So you'll be safe. So in fact, this did actually happen to one of our colleagues. Sorry. So this is Alien's car, and he's driving at probably 11 p.m. in Beijing, just after an accident, and he's going to a warehouse and meeting these guys who need to give him some money. So, yeah, that's useful.
So imagine you get in an accident, and the only way to resolve it is driving 2 hours outside of town to some unmarked warehouse at 11 o'clock at night, and those dudes get out of the van. Yeah, and then you have to negotiate basically what they're going to pay, because you can't take them to court. This is everyday life for most new car drivers.
Mm-hmm. All right. So right now, because I'm here in the States, I'm actually getting used to seatbelts again, because we don't really wear seatbelts in China. It's not compulsory, and the traffic is really pretty insane, like especially in Shanghai. We're moving along at like 20, 30. So people kind of feel that we don't need seatbelts, and the police doesn't really care. So look at these. What do you think these are, like these cartoon things? Sorry? Yep, exactly. So these are seatbelt cancelers. So people think that the beep that actually reminds you to put on your seatbelt, that's really annoying for them. So you actually get these seatbelt cancelers so you can plug them in so that the beep goes away. So that's uniquely Chinese. All right. Detailed performance. So as we mentioned, for a lot of people in China, the first car that they buy is usually in their 20s, late 20s. They get married. Their parents help finance it. And they're really concerned about the well-being of their car. There's this whole culture of wanting to know how your car is doing. Are you treating it well? And then also wanting to compare those metrics with other drivers. So there really is a need for detailed performance feedback. And what a lot of people do is also go online to all these communities, which exist especially for cars. And you have ones that are like specific to like models and makes. And you go on there and you exchange like tips and information. And it's not just in case of an accident or if you need to find out information. People are doing this on an everyday basis. It's almost like gaming. It's like, this is how my car's doing. How's your car doing? So that's pretty exciting for us. Okay, next up, Brandon's going to take us through healthcare.
A couple things about healthcare. To start off, we have 8.87% of the population is over 65. That may seem like a small number to you, but it's the highest number in the world. Well, that's one out of 1.34 billion people. That's a lot of senior citizens that need caring for. Combine that with the lack of doctors and nurses. If you look at the USA, the average patient, there's eight times as many patients in hospitals. There are fewer doctors. There's 40 number of patients per day for junior doctors. These are people who have 1 to 2, 3 years experience. 60 for senior doctors. So the more senior you become means, or if you become more senior, it's inherently true that you can handle more people, not fewer. So the model is reversed in China. And 10 minutes is the average time that doctors spend with patients. So scale and throughput is the most important problem that the healthcare networks face. Some things that we've seen are these enhanced community healthcare centers. These are semi-public. So in other words, the government runs most of the healthcare system today, but we're starting to see them loosen those laws a bit. So for example, you'll have a senior citizen who's given, for a small fee, given a phone that can connect to a hotline 24 hours a day. And it's not just so that they can get health advice. It's so that she can get bread or eggs or ask for help with her gas bill or anything like this. We also see people using mobile technology to try to respond to this throughput and make the systems more efficient. So we see a lot of things, especially with senior citizen care homes and even hospital networks, where this is essentially a pre-treatment. While the patient is waiting, it's a pre-treatment message for the patient. It gives them instructions on what to do post-treatment. So you get plenty of text messages not only before but also after. And the reason they do this is because they don't have time to spend with the patients. And then you have limited resources. So if you think about the queuing that goes on in the hospital with this many patients, it's quite intense. So you have, what are on the average, a couple hundred people waiting at any given time in any given major hospital in China.
That's even early in the morning because I've tried that.
Yeah. So we're starting to see services like this pop up that's actually a queue system, so you can pre-queue without having to go and wait in line. This is really basic stuff, but it's important to know that this is actually really disruptive because the government isn't sanctioning this. And from this point on, this is going to be a bigger opportunity for semi-public or private institutions to come in and create better services for people.
Explain this one more time.
Imagine you have to go to the hospital. There's a 200-person queue. And this lets you sign up for that queue and not have to wait. Yeah? It's just text messaging. It's a text messaging system. It's not a mobile app. Obviously, it's a feature phone, right? Yeah.
All right. Next up, we're going to talk about shopping. Well, retail, really. But it's one of my favorite things about China. So just in the last year alone, Chinese shoppers spend $5.7 billion shopping outside of China. So that's not even domestic shopping. That's just what they're shopping outside. And this is USDCN.com. And this is something that we use when we want to buy something from the States. So I need my new jeans from Anthropologie, but we don't have Anthropologie in China. So you can order online through this website, and it gets delivered to an address in the US and then shipped over to you in China. So a lot of companies are waking up to the fact that Chinese consumers actually have this desire for goods that are produced outside, and they actually want all these labels that haven't set up shop yet. So ShopBop, in fact, recently introduced it, and they have like reduced rates of shipping to China. So again, great opportunity for international retailers. USZCN.com. Mm-hmm. All right, so even though Chinese consumers spend a lot of money when they go traveling, like actually I was reading this report that said in Paris at the Louis Vuitton store, they had to limit the number of bags to each Chinese passport to 2 bags because they were running out of stock because there were so many people queuing up to buy their new collection. But even though Chinese consumers are spending so much money on luxury goods, when it comes to everyday shopping, they're quite price conscious. So this is something called Velo, and we have this in all the metro stations in Shanghai. And what this really is a system that allows you to sign up for a special discount card. You go online, you buy this card, and then when you get off the metro station, wherever you are, you can look for the best local deals of the day, and that's usually related to food. So that's like your local KFC that's doing a special meal or a giveaway or bubble tea, which is really popular in China. So even though they might spend lots of money on the most luxurious brands and shoes and everything, when it comes to just everyday things like food, they're going to try to save money.
Oh, it's one more thing. It's also a convenience factor, right? Mm-hmm. So taking convenience to the extreme. So the other thing that we've seen in the metro stations now is wraps around the columns where you'll have life-size displays of... and they're just posters, but life-size displays of products that you can get at a convenience store or a supermarket. And you can use a QR code with your phone to order that. And after your 40-minute train ride home, 15 minutes later, those groceries show up on your doorstep.
Mm-hmm. One of the things we always tell our Western clients when they come to China is this importance of negotiation. So it's a really famous case study in China now, the whole story of how and why Best Buy failed. But one of the reasons Best Buy didn't do so well in China is because they advertised their universal premise, right? They said, we can match any advertised price. So you come to us, you tell us you're getting a better deal on this particular product, and we'll sell it to you at that price. But actually in China, that means nothing. Because the price that's advertised, or the sticker that's actually on that product, that's just a starting point. You expect it to negotiate. It's part of the process. If you don't negotiate, it's actually insulting for the buyer and the seller. So you negotiate for everything, from like your vegetables to your washing machine. It's just part of the deal. So who cares what the price stays? And then, actually, the shop assistants in the major retail stores across China will have these secret lists that they don't actually bring out, but we got to see them. And this list has the real price. So this is as low as they'll go. And this has nothing to do with like what it says on the sticker. So this is really exciting. But because negotiation is so big, we have Taobao, which is like the biggest online retail in China. And they've actually taken advantage of this. So what Taobao allows you to do is actually speak to the seller before you decide to buy that product and go through your negotiation process. And then once you get the product, of course, you can pay for it in cash. And I've done this so many times for like shoes, bags, things for my house. It's just part of the process of buying something in China. Okay, let's talk about IKEA. It's really different in China. I don't know how many of you have been there, but this is a real experience hack. So this is what happens in an IKEA store in China. Families go there to hang out, and they take their camera with them. So this is where they actually have really special family memories. You know, they're sitting on beautiful tables, their kids are all dressed up, and they're taking all these fabulous photos. But IKEA encourages you to feel at home. So that's not just a showroom, that's your living room. Take your newspaper with you, bring your coffee in, kick back, take it easy, have a good time. That's all good. The cafeteria at IKEA is in itself a destination. It's become so popular that they actually have takeaway meals now at IKEA in China. And this is really exciting. They also have a thriving senior citizen dating scene. So if you go there, I think Saturday mornings, you'll see all these older people sitting around just chatting. You know, they've got some company. And it's really interesting that IKEA has become this place for them to congregate. Here's something else that's uniquely Chinese. So you want to buy this chair, right? I mean, you could go to IKEA and you could buy it and they'd like send it over. Or you could go to IKEA with your carpenter and have him take photos of it and take measurements and then completely customize it for you. And this is what we see people doing. So you're not going to IKEA to buy as much as to buy ideas. So this is something that has huge implications. And I think the most exciting thing is that IKEA has actually encouraged this because they realize this is how things are in China. And if you try to stop people from doing these things, which are so deeply embedded in their culture, you're going to lose out. So why not just become part of it? All right, next up, Brandon's going to talk about mobile.
As we were giving this speech last week in China to a Chinese audience, the number just hit 1 billion mobile users. So it's really hard to keep up with the pace of growth. It's 70% of the population now, I think. 36% are on the mobile net. They're using mobile first. That means they're not getting online through any other means. So it's quite impressive, the amount of growth in mobile. Does anyone know what this photo is? This date, ring a bell? This is in Beijing. This is the launch of the iPhone 4S at an Apple store. The impact of an international brand like Apple in a country where you have 1.3 billion people is being seen over and over again. And it's something that Apple doesn't quite realize yet. Their stores are the largest in China as they are anywhere in the world. They're the largest stores. And yet those stores are packed 24 hours a day almost. But even though iPhone is nice, it's still niche. The real thing that's going to happen in the next year or so is on Android. This is Xiaomi. This is a low-end smartphone that sold 100,000 in 3 hours that was made by a local startup. So you think back to that friend of ours that made the toy. Yeah, this was just a couple of guys, basically. They had experience in the industry, but they were able to do this basically bootstrapping. It's not just software bootstrapping like you see in the States. It's hardware bootstrapping. There will be many, many more cases like this come up in the future. Another thing we have to think about when we're working with clients and trying to launch new products is what happens after you launch it and it gets copied, right? And how do you deal with how many people are going to become users within a certain amount of time? So Twitter's first 36 months, 50 million. Weixin, on the other hand, did it in 10 months. Weixin is a social networking and communications platform that launched in China last year. Here's a couple other screenshots of it. These things are starting to outpace things like Twitter, services like Facebook. Originally, they were all clones, and now those have gone away for the most part. And there's still some feature comparison that you can do, but they've gone way beyond. So voice over IP, photos, these kinds of things have been happening now in China for quite a while. Another thing they've come up with is shake to find someone nearby. So cute little fun features. People love these things in China. You can put a message in a bottle and send it out and then receive that message randomly from anyone else that's using Weixin. So they're thinking of new ways that people can connect. They're outpacing, and they're not afraid to just put things out there and see what happens. And finally, one more story. This is a guy named Token. He's another friend of ours. He built customized Honda Zoomer motorcycles, scooters, because they weren't available in China. So he was able to connect to different manufacturers around Shanghai and start customizing and building his own scooters and selling them on his own. One-man show. Now, again, this is a little bit of an extreme case, but when you think about the backyard of China really being a manufacturing powerhouse, this capability is changing the things that we make, and it's changing the way that we make things. And no more is this more true where you have people that are previously thought of as pure consumers that are now creators. I think we like to talk about that a lot in the West, but it's when you see things like Xiaomi, when you see things like this, the ability to hack and create hardware at such a high degree of fidelity is really impressive. And I think they're actually leading the way when it comes to these things. So that's it. That's our talk. And we want to open it up for discussion and Q&A with you guys. You guys have any questions? Yeah?
In terms of how your research on China is applied, how much of it is for product development for Chinese consumers versus inspiration for product development for other countries?
It varies over the years. It's probably about 60% Chinese right now, 40% either Asia-Pacific companies or Western multinationals that are looking to understand China.
Can you talk about the breakdown of the economic balance of the, in terms of how strong is the middle class and what direction is it going? Do you see it be going, the greater between the lower class and the upper class and the middle class kind of dying? What was the trend in China?
Well, in China, it's really the middle class that has a lot of the power, and it's growing every single day. So just think about the advances in education, for example, and even the implications of the one-child policy. It means that every single day, hundreds and thousands of new consumers are being added to the market.
How many of you saw the train crash news in China? Huge disaster, right? One of the reasons that the government responded in the way that it did, a major response came from the government. Now, I know for us, when you see things like that in America, you may not see the whole story. The reason they did that is because of the middle class. It's because the reaction that the middle class had, and that they were using things like Sina Weibo and Tencent Weibo to talk about this and to blame the government and to speak openly against it.
So. And they really are the first generation to do this. Like 10, even 15 years ago in China, it would have been unheard to come out publicly and say something bad about the Chinese government. But now you've got a whole new young generation, and they're hyper-connected, and they will criticize the government, and they will talk about things that are happening. So it's almost like the government is forced to react.
How it's different from Twitter. It has a lot more features, first of all. People don't use it to create any kind of personal real-life connection. It's all virtual connections. So the relationship is fundamentally different with people. Another way in it's different is it's more lifestyle. It's more casual. So you get millions and millions and millions of people posting photos of their food. Like more like Path, right? And so the content on the network is very different, right? Because people don't necessarily want to use it as a source of point of view or debate or opinion unless there's something really important to talk about.
Do like brands play in this space the same way they would here?
I think that they are starting to wake up and realize, but not in the same sophisticated way that we see it happening in the West.
I don't think we've seen brands really take advantage. I mean, they're all over these networks for sure, but I don't think we've seen brands take advantage in compelling ways yet. It's more just kind of doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's sporadic.
Have you seen Chinese social media companies become more successful monetizing their services, or are they not making
moves in that area yet? Tencent is, and they're doing it through gaming. So they have a massive gaming platform, and they're integrating the gaming platform into that. But in terms of ad-based revenue or anything like that, no. And it's not part of their strategy. It won't. They say it won't be for the next 2 to 3 years. Well, that's a great question. I'm not sure I know the answer to that, but I would say that they're making so much money from the gaming that it's not as big of a pressure.
Are there platforms that allow you to analyze social data in real time?
No, that's just a Western
not
trend.
Yet.
It's a Western trend. The APIs are extremely typically closed, usually only accessible by the government.
How are the regional differences changing?
Well, the regional differences are still really pronounced, and we see this when we do research because we actually go live with our consumers for weeks at a time. And it's really interesting to see, like, if you go to North China, South China, even small provinces, there's still a lot of differences. But yeah, like, cities are catching up. So you can go to a tier 2, tier 3 city in China, and now you see they have a lot of the same brands that we do in Shanghai or Beijing, and the levels of awareness are also increasing. But tastes are still different.
It's a tape delay. Everything is on a tape delay, basically. People know it, and they don't really care. I say the general attitude is of apathy in China.
Yeah.
It doesn't. The amount of fervor that we see in the Western press over this issue compared to the Chinese press. Now, it is, there's a given, like, if they could talk about this, would they then? That's the ultimate question. But you see, again, going back to the train crash, right? They talked about it. When it was important enough, they were criticizing the government, and they didn't care whether that tape delay was in effect or not.
We know.
Are people's concerns more private or community in the way that they sort of grapple with it? Do you understand the question? Am I worried about my family, or am I creating big blocks of people that will change things?
I think it's more personal at this point. So it's very much about taking care of yourself and the people you love. And that has implications for healthcare, right? So just in the way that people use traditional Chinese medicine. I mean, even our Chinese colleagues at Frog, when we get sick, they actually give us traditional Chinese medicine. So it's about taking care about your loved ones. But I think that slowly that is starting to change. People are starting to be more and more concerned about air quality, food quality, and they are starting to form groups. So I think it will change in the next few years.
Well, they're also, though, they're really trusting of the government to take care of that for them, I think.
Is the government starting to loosen up in terms of imports? I know they used to be real tight on restrictions. Everything had to be made pretty much in China. They'd export a lot, but they wouldn't. So they started to loosen up now, opening up the American markets a little bit more?
I don't know. I think a lot of people disagree whether that's true or not. I know, for example, the iPhones, it's a 30% markup usually, 15 to 30% markup on Mac products, and they still buy them in those numbers. So.
What role do brands play in
Huge.
Good question.
So we see this a lot, like for automotive, for example. People are really excited by international brands, right? And it matters a lot, like the level of prestige, the country of origin, so Japanese versus German versus American. But the understanding around brand is still a bit naive. So it's still about the biggest brands, who's advertising more. And just by that, they're judging the quality of it. But brands are becoming more and more important. Yeah, sometimes they can. That's a great question. We actually saw this while we were living in South China. So we were working for an international American client, and we saw a number of Chinese brands that actually had managed to copy the packaging or even the formula to a great extent. But in a sense, I think this is an opportunity for brands, right? Because one, you can take advantage of the Shanzai brands. That's what we call like the cheap imitations if you do it smartly. Secondly, it's also a great lesson to learn to innovate quicker. So you've almost got to start thinking like two steps ahead of everybody else who's going to copy you. So start planning what you're going to do next year and the year after.
It looks like Frog bring up like an observation of Chinese social culture. Do you guys like design something to improve their service, like hospital service?
Most of the work that we do is confidential, so we can't really answer that question, sorry. I hate having to say that too. I'm sorry. Yeah, sure. So what Kaj was just referring to was we were designing mosquito repellent for consumers in China. Tencent Weibo is a software social platform, right? We're helping new car brands both create the brand, a new native Chinese car brand that's going to go global, create that brand, but also create the design of the car itself, the interior design, the HMI system, the customer support services, things like that. In the healthcare space, usually we work in devices, so things like things such as radiotherapy, MRI systems, mammography units, these kinds of things.
Mm. We also work on CPG, which is my favorite. So we're starting to work on cosmetics, you know, creating new brands for Asian consumers. We're also starting to work on candy, for example. So, yeah, it's really exciting.
You guys are there on the ground, living, observing a very rapidly changing culture. Are there suggested English language sources that we could take a look at to try to keep pace of what's happening? Maybe a couple that you might suggest?
ShanghaiS.com. That's a
yeah,
good start.
Actually, the Shanghaiist is the volume on that is phenomenal, and they cover all issues. Yeah. Mm. If you're specifically interested in the tech world, I would say there's a site. Is it TechRice?
Yeah, TechRice.
Yeah, TechRice.com is really good. It's an in-gadget for China, you know, in a sense.
China Dialogue.
Yeah.
And People's Daily Online, that's the Chinese newspaper. So if you want to read about things from that perspective, it's always interesting. People's Daily Online. All right, any other questions?
So traditionally in Chinese software, their UI is a lot more do you see that changing at all?
No. No, it's loved, I think. Yeah. It's just it's embedded in the way that they comprehend UIs. Yeah.
I think it's really different, the understanding. Like a page that looks really busy and crowded to my Chinese friends, that's actually giving them a lot of different information, so it's not necessarily a bad thing.
I think with specifically with video platforms, you have to answer the question of copyright protection and how they're going to monetize that. And increasingly, you see them creating monetizable avenues for licensed content. You take like the NBA, for example, especially now with Jeremy Lin. Like that content, because you pay for that, even in China. And the NBA has licensing deals with Youku and Tudou and some of the others. I can't say. I'm not sure we've actually studied that topic.
So sorry, we haven't gone deep into that.
Yeah. It's... Well, the internet is a lot slower. Yeah, that's the way it responds. I mean, they can't build, and they can't grow fast enough, right?
So the growth of the whole multimedia experience and having the video integrations and everything on the global is their primary
price. Yeah. I think it will take longer. I guess that if that's a software issue, the hardware issue would be the analog would be. The train systems, right? They can't build train systems fast enough for the throughput of people going not only from city to city, but within the cities.
Mm-hmm. Are the Chinese traveling to other countries and shopping
I think they actually go in these groups, and one of the things that they're told by their guide is that it doesn't work the same way in Europe, for example. So they are actually trained not to embarrass themselves, for example, by trying to negotiate for a bag. And actually, it's quite contradictory, but there is a certain pride amongst Chinese consumers in being able to afford something that's outrageously expensive. So it's funny, because when it comes to everyday things, of course, you want to negotiate and get the best deal, but it's great to say that you bought this one bag and it costs like $4,000.
Can you talk about the difference between someone having a social media profile like in the Western world compared to what it would be like in China? Because I know they're trying to project a lot of, like, it's a certain image you want to project of yourself versus you would be about connecting with your friends and stuff. So how is it different? Like, would they have a personal profile and have their parents as friends or their friends?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think it isn't that different. Yeah, there may be difference in the ways people connect or the content that they post, but there's a lot of universality there. So I guess I would challenge the question a bit, and at least in the work that we're doing when we see with Tencent Weibo, the type of profiles that consumers want when we go into testing and when we do user research, the type of information they want to show and project, some seem somewhat similar. Well, can't answer that question, I apologize. Can't reveal that information. But I will say that I think the headquarters of Frog will be in Shanghai in 5 to 10 years.
That's
kind of a joke, but...
We also have a huge studio in Shanghai, so I've been hanging at our studio here in Austin, and it's beautiful. It's awesome. We have a huge studio. Currently, we're about 50 people, 55 this month, but we do see ourselves growing hugely over the next few years. So, yeah.
Only in Shanghai.
It's exciting to be there.
Yes.
If you had to start a business in China, would you say definitely start it in mainland China, or would you look at maybe setting it up in Hong Kong? How do you generate profits?
Why do you want to get it out of the country?
Well, because just the type of people I've spoken to, they just say it's very hard to, in terms of how they structure businesses, they don't make profit or make very little profit because you did generate profit. How do you, what do you then use the profit to generate that profit? What do you then do with it if you can't? It has to stay in China.
Yeah. Yeah. I have no idea.
You know,
sorry.
I can't answer like the business regulation part of it, but I used to live in Hong Kong before I moved to Shanghai. And in Shanghai, I actually meet a lot more entrepreneurs. So we meet a lot more people who've actually started their own business. And these aren't just Chinese. I have a lot of friends who are expats who've moved to China to start their own businesses. So I would imagine it's probably a better place to be right now.
I think it depends on the brand and whether there's a story. That's always the thing. Do you have a story that's going to resonate with people? The thing about connecting across social networks in China that I think is missing right now is a more nuanced, segmented approach instead of just a blast. Yeah, and there is no niche in China when you're talking about segmentation. You know, They're of every kind of nuanced, very detailed. What would be a good example of this? People that own four phones or more,
yeah,
and manage their SIM, manage seven SIM cards. There's 40 million people in China that do that. You know, so. But brands don't take that kind of thing into consideration, at least that I see. So yeah. There may be some things that I'm not seeing, though, for sure.
But I think that's going to change, because I think the numbers in China are so exciting, but they're also so huge that it's almost impossible to manage unless you drill down. Any other questions?
There's some interesting things, for example, people getting paid, and armies of people getting paid to use social networks to create content and to create followers. I don't know, does that exist in the West right now? I mean, armies, like 100 people that are getting paid to post content. Yeah. I would say both, yeah. I would say it's not just for messaging, official messaging. Another thing that may not be digital enough for you, but I think I still consider it digital, is when you look at things like subtitles. Subtitling of movies happens in 8 hours, and it's crowdsourced in China. So anything that needs to be translated can and will be translated online right away for a Chinese audience. So the cost there is also approaching zero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's great because you wake up in the morning and you have, like, translated TV shows.
Can you talk a little more about crowdsourcing? A couple of examples?
Translation is a really big one. People use translation services online. You can send a document to get translated, and it gets crowdsourced within an hour.
Mm.
Yeah.
Maps is another one that we've recently been looking at. It's really interesting because the cities of China are changing so rapidly that, like, Baidu Maps, which is what we use in China, isn't actually able to keep up. So if you want to get to a particular destination, a lot of people will actually now crowdsource directions. Of those directions. I think you just drive and hopefully you get there, and when you do,
well,
you verify.
Well, there's an implicit trust that that's actually more accurate than the official data, basically. Yeah, because the roads or the infrastructure has not been mapped out to a certain degree of detail in some cases, or it's changing so fast. So how do we see that changing?
How does it affect us? It doesn't affect me much, actually.
Yeah, I don't think it... Not at all.
No. When you first get to China, yeah, it's a bit weird because you can't access your Facebook or New York Times or Twitter, but then you get VPN, which is how we access the stuff, and I don't know, it just becomes easy and normal, and I don't know, maybe we're desensitized to some extent, but it does not affect us personally.
Mm.
Right, but actually, once you start looking at China, you see it in online, you see a huge movement of nationalism, support them.
You do.
Sure.
You do, and I don't think that's going to continue. Yeah, that's not going to change. I guess we've misunderstood the question. It doesn't seem to affect us personally. I don't think it affects the expat population of China too much.
They don't have a different view of foreign businesses.
In a lot of cases, and this goes back to that brand question earlier, in a lot of cases, they don't know the difference. They can't. They have trouble distinguishing that a brand is actually a foreign brand. Yeah, if a brand has done its job well, or if the name that that was chosen is the right name. Coca-Cola had to change its name 3 times in the early 20s and 30s, and they finally got it right. Yeah.
Yes, we will. Yeah, so you can follow us on Twitter, and we'll actually put the link on it. Brandon's at Bred, B-R-E-D, and I'm at Kaj186, so we'll post links.
Cool, okay. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Appreciate it.